Welcome to Here We Stand. I'm your regular host, Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. It's February 24th, 2019, and welcome to all of you new listeners for a special program today featuring a breaking news communique received in the last hour from the International Tribunal of Crimes of Church and State concerning the deposing of Pope Francis in Rome over the last few days. Most of the show will consist of an interview with a member of the Ninth Circle cult, a man raised intergenerationally in the satanic cult, and we're going to precede that with reading the communique, and you'll see the reason for the testimony following this communique. For new listeners, what you're listening to, this program, is part of an ongoing history, over 10 years in Europe, 25 years in North America, of a campaign to document and prosecute and stop crimes by church and state of genocide, of child trafficking, of satanic killings. Today, we'll begin with the breaking news communique and public advisory issued today by the International Tribunal of Crimes of Church and State, the ITCCS. Behind a media smokescreen, Pope Francis is stripped of authority by a trio of top cardinals. Scheduled Ninth Circle cult ceremony is suspended following diplomatic and public protests. Rome. If you believe the official media accounts, Pope Francis spent the last several days in Rome conferring with a group of cardinals and then all of his bishops about child abuse in the Catholic Church. In truth, the event was a cover story designed to camouflage a palace coup at the Vatican. Operating behind the smokescreen of the widely publicized conference, three senior cardinals assumed the reins of power from Francis last Friday, February 22nd, in a repetition of the fate of his predecessor, Pope Benedict, who was forced to resign from his office on February 11, 2013. As with Benedict, Francis was deposed just prior to the regular conclave of the elite Ninth Circle sacrificial cult on February 23rd and 24th that occurred at the San Lorenzo Episcopus Church, just a block from Vatican City in Rome. But unlike 6 years ago, the Ninth Circle never held its grisly ceremony this past weekend, thanks to a diplomatic protest and a crowd of angry demonstrators. According to a confidential and high-level source within the Roman Curia, the removal of Pope Francis occurred last Friday morning when the Vatican Secretary of State, Cardinal Pietro Parolin, met with Francis in the presence of two other senior cardinals, Marc Ouellet of Canada and Gerhard Müller of Germany. All three men are actively associated with the Ninth Circle cult. On behalf of the bishops' conference, Cardinal Ouellet informed Francis that he had lost the confidence of both the bishops and the College of Cardinals. Secretary of State Parolin followed by stating that henceforth, he, Ouellet, and Müller would operate as interim coadjutors of the Holy See and the Papacy, thereby removing Francis from office. To avoid adding to the crisis within their church, Francis' removal would be kept secret from the public, and he would remain as a figurehead, but would exercise no authority. Now, in both cases, Popes Benedict and Francis ran afoul of the Ninth Circle and its influential backers because of how their overt association with occult ceremonies had brought too much attention to it. Benedict presided openly at the Circle's sacrificial rituals, both as a cardinal and as the Pope, according to Ninth Circle eyewitnesses Toos Nienhuis and Anne-Marie van Blijenburg. Francis not only attended the rituals and provided children for them while he was an archbishop in Argentina, but he is intimately connected to members of the Dutch royal family involved with the Ninth Circle, including Queen Maxime Zoriega, with whom Francis has maintained a clandestine romance for nearly 20 years. Sources state that evidence of this romance was presented to Cardinal Parolin's office by a diplomatic courier last Monday, and that delivery prompted the showdown with Francis and his removal. Now, despite this preemptive strike against Francis, yesterday's scheduled Ninth Circle ceremony did not come off smoothly, but in fact was disrupted. The same day as Francis' removal, last Friday the 22nd, a European government, possibly the same state that sent the courier with evidence of the Pope's involvement with Maxime Zoriega, the same government issued a diplomatic note of concern to Cardinal Parolin's office regarding the impending Ninth Circle sacrificial ceremony, where normally several children are ritually killed and cannibalized. That government also contacted Interpol and the Italian government with its concern and asked that police intervene to investigate and halt the ceremony. In addition, last night, and thanks to the extensive reporting of these events by alternative media and the ITCCS, more than two dozen people converged on the San Lorenzo Episcopus Church, where the ceremony was to occur, and they attempted to enter the building. This group included a special team of ITCCS sheriffs who had previously disrupted Ninth Circle covens in Zwolle, Holland, and Montreal, Canada. A small riot began at the church, and the state police were called. No one was arrested, but policemen entered the church. It was later reported by a source within the police, the Polizia di Stato, that the ceremony had not occurred and that five individuals within the church, as well as two small children, had been detained by their officers. However, the Polizia and the Vatican both refused to confirm or deny these incidents. The ITCCS team leader and other witnesses have filed statements about the incidents with the tribunal. These statements will be made public as part of upcoming news updates. Now, the fact that two successive popes have been suddenly forced from their offices, both prior to the Ninth Circle February Coven, after both popes had been publicly charged and convicted in common law court cases for crimes against humanity, should cause even the most doubtful observer to glimpse the depth of the institutional rot in the Vatican and the power of the common law and the people to bring these crimes to justice. Regardless of who holds formal power in the Church of Rome, it remains a convicted transnational criminal organization actively engaged in child trafficking, torture, and murder. Under international law and the law of God, the Vatican has lost all authority and legitimacy. Its assets and properties are liable for seizure, and its head offices are subject to immediate arrest under standing common law arrest warrants. Now, in the weeks ahead, our sheriffs will be working with governments and police agencies to detain and bring to civil trial, any Catholic official or clergyman or their accomplices who are engaged in the harming of children. Our campaign will include a series of direct actions during Easter week from April 14th to 21st. We call upon the people of the world to join us in this campaign by boycotting the Roman Catholic Church, denying it all funding, and demanding that their governments stop aiding and abetting church crime by canceling all tax exemptions and privileges enjoyed by that church. This communique will be broadcast on YouTube this week. Further updates will follow on this program every Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern, 11 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, issued by the Central Office of the International Tribunal of Crimes of Church and State, the ITCCS, February 24th. Now, the interview you're about to hear was from the year 2016, and it involves a man called Dave Staffen, who was raised within the Ninth Circle cult in Canada. He makes reference to the Anglican Church of Canada, which, along with the Roman Catholic Church, is actively involved with the Ninth Circle. Next week, we'll be having more updates about the events in Rome, the campaign in April, and how you can be involved in shutting down this child-killing institution. For a copy of this communique, write to thecommonland@gmail.com. Thank you.
Day, Rabbi, sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I.
Welcome to Radio Free Canada. I'm your host, Kevin Annett. It's September 18th, 2016, and welcome back to all of you, especially to our new listeners from the Veterans Today Network and new listeners in Russia, Germany, and the Czech Republic, especially who are tuning in today. Hello and welcome to all of you, and to all our regular listeners. As you know, if you've tuned in this year and last year to our show, you are part of a new covenant of free men and women who recognize no authority save that established under the natural law and according to their own conscience. We take this stand today in opposition to global hypocrisy that is threatening our lives, our children, and our liberties. We're in dire trouble, people, as you know. We're not talking about just the problems on the show. We are arming people to deal with them. We are not only raising consciousness, but our capacity to reclaim ourselves and our world. That's why this program features not only news updates, inspirational messages, and reports from the front line, but training workshops for freedom fighters. So you can follow a lot of that at itccs.org, here every Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and also on any of the other broadcasts that we periodically post. Now, today on Radio Free Canada, along with my semi-regular co-host, Ryan Gable, is our guest, Dave Staffen. Dave, as you know, if you've read our posting, is a survivor of satanic ritual crimes in Canada, in Ontario. Dave is going to talk about his experience. We're going to link what happened to him with other news items we'll be talking about today before and after Dave is on. One of them being the fact that in the course of a lot of our work, we've discovered that these tortures of the innocent, the satanic ritual killing and murder of children, is tied into the actions of those who are really psychopathic in nature, the elite who run this global corporatocracy. And we recognize that these attacks on all of us are designed to so traumatize us that they can rule and tyrannize us more effectively. So the issue that we're going to talk about today is not confined to a bunch of weirdos in red robes. It's an attack on all of us, and this is what we want to emphasize. I bring on
there. Yes, I am. Can you hear me okay?
I can. I can hear you fine. Thanks, Ryan. You know, I wanted to just, for some of our listeners who may not really know what we're talking about when we say satanic ritual abuse, you've done a lot of reading in the esoteric nature of this, but, you know, what is it that when people say SRA or the Satanism or whatever, what is it they're talking about?
Well, there's a different classification for different fields of work, I believe. In esotericism, for example, and mythology, Satan is the god Saturn, a spirit of opposition, a necessary evil that allows us to grow. And that form of Satanism in the material world gets grouped in together with kind of folk Satanists or satanic witchcraft, where you are utilizing somebody else's body, energy, property for a selfish personal gain or to simply just cause destruction, murder, rape. And these fields of Satanists are very, very, very small in the world, at least from my experience and from the experience of others I've dealt with. However, there are certain sects that do practice this form of Satanism, and they're completely different than the Anton LaVey Church of Satanism. So in terms of SRA abuse, it's a form of physical abuse, mental abuse, spiritual abuse. It's aimed at children, adults, teenagers, everybody from every age group. And it's a form, if you think of it as of a form of organized ritual that may incorporate certain elements from religious practices, that may incorporate certain elements that are geared towards generating fear and essentially extracting something from the victim, even if it's just taking away their sense of self. And generally, you might actually refer to these people as some form of vampire or Satanist in the term of like a blood-sucking parasite. So that's how I classify it. It's different for every person, though.
Right. Now, one of the things that we're going to go into some detail today and actually over the next number of weeks with other guests is the fact that one of the patterns you find when these tortures occur of children is not only is it intergenerational, it involves families. Women actually used as breeders to have babies that are then sacrificed,
right.
Children that are raised within the cult. One of the phenomena you find constantly is the police refuse to intervene. The police either don't believe it or will not respond. And that at every level, courts, politicians, counselors simply refuse this is going on. Now, in your opinion, is that because they're colluding or is it just about a level of ignorance and denial?
Well, again, it's a combination of both and more. It's a combination of involvement or it's a combination of denial, and that combination of involvement and or denial might be mixed and primarily is mixed with fear of what will happen if you do speak out against it. A lot of judges and a lot of high officials in government and corporations are involved in this. So even if you are a police officer or somebody that wants to do the right thing, sometimes it becomes very difficult to do the right thing when you try to attempt to do it. You may be threatened with losing your job, pension, or you might have your family threatened.
Right. Well, you know, the other piece to this, which I'll just mention before we bring Dave on, is, of course, the church angle. We have documented thoroughly on murderbydecree.com the heavy involvement of especially the Vatican and the Church of England in these satanic ritual crimes, the activities of the Ninth Circle, a satanic cult in both the Church of England and the Church of Rome that goes back to at least the 18th century. Again, we'll be going into this in more detail, but I wanted to flag this because one of Dave's points, of course, is that these crimes were occurring in an Anglican church not far from the Anglican Indian residential school that called the Mushole or the Mohawk School in Brantford, Ontario, where children were killed systematically. And, you know, we did a whole attempted archaeological excavation there that did reveal children's bones and buttons before it was shut down by the government. And so I want to draw that link especially. There's this whole religious aspect and how it continues to involve high church officials. With that said, I'm going to bring on Dave now. Hopefully he's on the line. Hello, Dave. Are you with us?
Yes, I am, Kevin.
David, it's an honor to be here, for you to be here with us. And I would like to just simply ask you in your own words to begin by telling us what happened to you as a child.
Okay. Well, I was born to parents who both adhered to the methods, practices, and traditions of Satanism. So at sometime in my second year, I think around 2.5, I was taken to events which I believe was at the bottom of the Anglican Church. And I was put through a series of tests, and this was like a night out for the adults. The women were there along with the men, and it was a lot of laughter and gaiety going on, except for me. So these were events to test your courage, will, loyalty, and compassion. And they don't really like you to have compassion, and they try and knock that out of you. So they would use animals, dogs, snakes, rats were all part of my memories of the two-year-old and the two-year-old, the second year. Actually, that would be, the second year. And fighting was involved. Often you'd have to fight on behalf of someone who you were supposed to be loyal to. So that went on for some period of time. Sometime in my third year, the events changed dramatically in purpose and demeanor. Women were no longer present. Sometimes the men wore robes, and there would oftentimes be chanting. And these events, like from the day you're born into a satanic family, the goal is to have you become one of them. And I heard those words over and over, is to become one of them. Does he have what it takes to become one of them? And as a two-year-old, they were excited about me. I exhibited courage. I exhibited will. And so at 3 years old was at the time that I would be initiated into the cult, sometime in my third year. And so the goal was to manipulate me into killing a human being by stabbing him through the heart with a knife. And so these events would be devised, and this went on and on. They'd all be different.
So did you not start with an animal? I've heard in some cases.
Well, when I was a little wee guy, probably early two, I can remember being with, in the basement, being trained how to kill small dogs and rabbits by stabbing them in the neck. That occurred. And as a little boy, you never hear the words, you are a good boy. You are never hugged. You are never kissed. You don't ever hear the words, I love you, because they want you to have a need for connection so that you will do what it takes to become one of them. They try and erode your compassion so that you will stab that man in the heart, and then you become one of them. And so these events went on, and they would manipulate them. They would be all different, so oftentimes it would be that I was supposed to protect a little baby or a little girl from, like one of them would be like a vicious dog was going to attack this girl, and I would have to protect her from the dog. And then I would be given the knife, and I would be able to kill the dog. They made sure the dog, I would be able to do that, and I remember that was one of them. But then the owner of that dog came, and he was very angry at me. Well, then they manipulated a bit further along the line that the man dressed the same way as the owner of the dog would be lying. And as I look back now, like those these men were always drugged and had their eyes were open, but they could hardly move. And they would always manipulate me into thinking I had to kill this man to save myself and the girl, and the little girl. But there was all different kinds of scenarios. This went on and on and on. And I would never kill. I would always yell no and throw the knife away. And at that time, as soon as I did that, I would be rushed by my dad and others, and I would be beat, and I would be sodomized and mind control programmed. And every time I said no, I knew that was going to happen, and it did happen. And so this went on and on and on. And my recollections at home were there was much pressure on my mom and dad because it looked like I wasn't going to become one of them. After a certain point, they kept thinking they could get me to their side. It's about dark versus light. And I realize now I had much protection and help from above, from heaven, because I was able to refuse them. They couldn't break my will to have me become one of them. This went on and on and on.
Dave, I'm sorry. Do you mind if I ask you, if you weren't cooperating, why did they keep you alive?
Well, unlike the native children who you've talked about, it's just not that easy to kill a white kid. You have to be careful in doing that. And I'm not sure exactly why they didn't do that, but they didn't. Right. I think they thought they could eventually get me to their side, but they couldn't. So other than that, I don't really know why they didn't kill me.
And this carried on for how long, Dave?
Well, the cult leader, when I was 5 years old, I remember I was in kindergarten, and something drastic happened at that time. The cult leader declared we must destroy him. If we don't destroy him, someday surely he will destroy us. And that destruction occurred for the next almost 50 years. But the main part of it was when I was 5 years old. And so they made me so fearful of confrontation through beatings. I was beat by older boys and more than one at a time at cult events for that year. And I mean multiple times per week. And one of them, I remember, I was supposed to go help this little boy who was going to be picked on. And I was five, and these three kids, maybe they were eight, they started beating me. And they beat me till I went unconscious. Now, I don't know if I went unconscious from just the fact the emotional impact of it or the beatings or the punches, but I went unconscious. I had water poured on me. When I got up, I was beat to unconsciousness again. When I woke up, I had water poured on me again, and again I was beat to unconsciousness. I was beat continuously, and what they did was they try and, Satanism's about hiding your attributes from you and making you into something you really aren't. And so they hid my courage underneath these layers upon layer upon layer of mind control programs and fear of confrontation.
Right.
And it was set up throughout my life that I would be put in situations where I would be challenged by people and I would be afraid. And of course, at the time when I refused to become one of them, at 3 years old, my dad was only 24. And it's hard to envision people who are Satanists. You know, they're exactly the opposite of what most of us are. To a Satanist, they live in an inverted world where love equals hate. And instead of forgiveness, they want revenge. Instead of cherishing a child, they use that child for their own perverted sexual gratification. So it's really hard when I went, as I was going through my healing, it took me some time to comprehend the level of depravity of these people that were so, which were a part of my life, because I was surrounded by them, because of course, since my mom and dad were Satanists, that's the kind of people that they associated with.
And could I ask you, Dave, when you were younger, I just wanted to ask, you referred to mind control techniques. Could you describe some of the methods they used on mind control?
The only method that was used on me that I'm aware of, at least as a very young child, was sodomy. You'd be sodomized, and that put you in such extreme pain. The mind control program would just be whispered in your left ear by my dad. It just basically bypasses the conscious mind and goes right into your subconscious. And
right.
So that mind control program is inside of you, and it is part of you, and that's it controls you, whatever that mind control program is.
How did you know that you were, like, when did you start to become aware of this? What happened? Was there an event, or did you get help from outside, or how did it happen?
I'd first like to just point out that my dad developed such a hatred for me because I embarrassed him and humiliated in front of his peer group. And he sought revenge against me for the rest of my life. One of the reasons I think I wasn't killed is because he wanted to torment me. Satanists love the torment of others. And I'm a prime witness for that. So I went through my life, like many other people, not knowing why I had lacks in the areas of self-love, self-esteem, and self-confidence, courage, things like this. And because Satanism hides that, hides your true essence behind all these layers of hate and blockages to your true self. I was 53 years old, and I didn't know this, and I was getting drugged by people I associated with, by my mom and dad, multiple times through the years, multiple times every year through the years. At 53 years old, it finally came to my attention that my anger was the cause of the problems in my marriage. And, you know, the anger was just always underneath and ready to burst out at the most inopportune time. And, you know, unfortunately, we usually take that out on those we love most. Although I was fairly tough on the people I worked with, too, but I had that anger. So when I finally realized that, I really believe God intervened and took me to a healer that could help me. And so I believe God healed me, facilitated through this lady, whose name is Sandra Fecht, who you've had on your show, I think. And so this will work for anybody. Her methods are simple to use and easy to learn. I learned many of them myself, and I did work every day from my meeting with her in 2008. Well, I didn't begin immediately using her methods until probably 6 months later, and by that time, I knew the truth of what had happened to me. And I had to start removing all the effects from the incidents of post-traumatic stress that are inherent within Satanism. And so one at a time, you remove them, like a skin on an onion, until eventually, and I worked on this every day, and of course, during that time, I became very spiritual, because spiritual work and healing work are one and the same thing, as each involves removing a block to God's love, which is our essence. So it's the same thing, really, spiritual work and healing. And so I started removing these blocks, and I worked on it every day since 2008. And I made a prayer probably in late 2008 or early 2009 that I declared my intention to God to be all I could be in love and light. And I asked him for his divine assistance in doing so. And I believe that prayer facilitated all the healing I've got. Much of it's through Sandra. The majority of it's through Sandra, but I've got healing through others and through prayer. And I consider myself most fortunate that happened.
David, I'm going to ask Ryan if he had any comments or questions, but Dave, let me ask you, at any point when this was going on, and it sounds like right up into your 50s, these attacks continued on you,
Did you ever go to the police?
Well, okay, so you're drugged with a drug similar to a date rape type drug where you have no conscious memory of any of this ever happening. And there's right. different kinds of drugs that do different things. I know a lot of times the drug, you would be sitting there and you could see what was going on, but you couldn't do anything about it. And then right. when you woke up the next day, you didn't have any conscious memory of it all. But of course, our body, our subconscious, stores everything. In the book, The Biology of Belief, which is written by Dr. Bruce Lipton, he states in the book that each cell in our body is an entity unto itself, and as such has its own brain. So collectively, these cells, they're all connected energetically with one another and form our subconsciousness. Everything that's ever happened to us is there, and it's so easy to access once you learn how to do it. And so that's where all this came from, and it completely transformed my life as I removed all the effects from the post-traumatic stress incident. I got to find out who I really was and what I really was. And once you find out what you really are, you basically know what your purpose in life is, right. or much of what your purpose in life is.
Dave, we're going to forego our normal break because I want to devote all the time to hearing from you. In that break, we had a couple of audio clips of residential school survivors who are describing things so similar to what you're saying. And, you know, I want to touch on that a bit later. But let me ask Ryan, do you have anything you want to ask?
Yeah, there's a couple of questions, but I'll stick with one or two. And that is your initial feeling when you first realized what was going on, maybe when you started working with Sandra, did you realize that this wasn't an isolated case with you and that there were a lot of others who also went through the same type of abuse within other communities and families?
I didn't get the second question. Let me start in there because so I started having these, I would have these memories, and of course God releases them to you in the order you're able to handle them. So first of all, I had the memories about killing the small animals, then being sexually abused by people I knew from my childhood. And I kept reporting back to my mom and dad what I was learning, which, you know, looking back now is kind of humorous because it must have started alarming them. And within 6 months, I realized that they were the architects of everything that had ever happened. All the conspiracies against me, they were the architects of it. When that became known to me, that triggered all the mind control fear programs that I'd been put into me since I was a little boy and had been reinforced throughout the years. And I was in a state of such immense fear that I couldn't even really operate. I couldn't function. I had to quit work. My son took over our business, ended up doing it a lot better than I did anyway, so that was all good. And I just devoted my time to healing. And it took me some time to overcome that fear. But the fear programs are, like I said, they're right in your subconsciousness, and some of mine were, and I'll just say them, but I want to mention that if anybody out there hears these mind control programs and it strikes a bit of fear in their hearts, there might be a reason for that. The programs for me, if you ever find out what we have done to you, we will kill you. We will kill your wife. We will kill your kids. There is no place to hide. We are watching you. We are everywhere. And, you know, just saying those doesn't sound maybe like much, but it was in every cell in my body. And it took me, I don't know, it took me a few months of prayer and intensive therapy to remove that stuff from me. And that thus began my transformation, because I had spent my whole life thinking I was a coward, and then all of a sudden I realized I wasn't, and that was quite an eye-opener to me as I started confronting those that I knew were part of the many right. times I had been drugged and stuff like that.
I want to talk about that for a minute, Dave. Did you do...
I'm sorry, I can't hear you, Kevin.
What did it look like? You said that you confronted the people who had
you know, who had tortured you and all that.
As my courage came back, maybe I should point out that on the day I realized my mom and dad were the architects of all the things that had happened to me and sometimes my family, I was in a state of fear. So I immediately went to a lawyer the next morning, and as I was coming out of the law office, two men were leaving my car, staring at me intently. Now, I saw that, but it didn't really register because I was in a state of shock and fear. When I got to my car, it had a huge dent on the very top of the fender. The two men that had been walking back from my car had been carrying something heavy wrapped in a blanket. The dent in my car could not have been put there by another car because it wasn't on the side, it was on the very top. And that was an act of intimidation that was meant to put fear in me, and it did. So then, as I took the negativity out of me and eventually started beginning to find out my true self, or find out what I was, I began confronting some of the people in the town where I lived at the time that I knew had been part of these acts. And I would confront them, say, look, I know what you did. The truth is going to come out. It would be best if you just went and told the police about it now. Like, I never got angry. I never threatened in any of the letters I sent or my confrontations. But in these confrontations, nobody ever denied it. Nobody ever spoke to me in a raised tone. They would just say something like, you think we would do that? And often I was just met with silence. Shortly after I started doing that, I had a brand new car, and it was stolen one night and firebombed. When I went to look at the car, it was totally melted. The tires had melted right off the rims. The inside was unrecognizable because it had all just melted away. All the plastic and leather just melted away.
So, Dave, would you say that this cult is still operating?
Well, they're all connected, so there really is no, we think of it as little cults. They're all connected. I've lived in probably 10 different communities in my adult life, and I've been drugged and accessed in every one of those towns because it must be as easy as FTD florist for my mom or dad, who are now passed away, to have grabbed the phone and called some cult person in the new town I lived and set up the operation where I would get drugged. And I'm sure some money changed hands. But the cult people enjoy in the torment of one of light. They enjoy tormenting me because I was one who refused to become one of them. So the other guy, the other person that maybe who I was even with that night, who would be a good person, they don't care about drugging him or hurting him because he didn't have the opportunity to become one of them like I did, and I refused them.
So you, what's the state of things now? Like, you've written people. I understand also that you wrote to the Anglican Church because of the fact that these things have been going on in an Anglican Church. Did you ever get a response?
Well, so I said before that you begin to know what your purpose is as you find out what you were. And I believe that part of my purpose is to make known the prevalence of cults, secret societies, and Satanism so people can protect themselves. So in 2011, letters just started coming to me. These letters, in kind of a spiritual way. And I would write these letters to the perpetrators. So I have wrote hundreds upon hundreds of letters. And sometimes, like, a letter might get sent to 80 different people. I sent them to the Anglican Church of Canada because that's where my abuse began. And I've never got one reply from them. I sent them to the Premier of Ontario, the OPP. None of the letters I've sent have been replied to. I've sent hundreds upon hundreds of letters to over 160 perpetrators. One of the letters I sent talked about the time I was sodomized in a satanic ritual in 2004, which occurred in front of a large group of people in the country.
in front of a very large group of people. So I sent this letter to 80 people who I allege have knowledge of or who witnessed, who took part in that event. None of those people who received that letter complained, took that letter to the police and said, and complained about it. And I sent hundreds of other letters of a similar nature of various events that maybe they were involved if to them. Now, these letters, like I said before, were not condemning. I said, if you ask God for forgiveness now, he will forgive you. I have forgiven you, but the truth needs to be known. And so I sent these letters for a period of about 5 years, four and a half years, to various people. Time and time again, different letters. I wrote a book. I think you read part of it. Mm-hmm. In the chapter, there's chapter 8 called Betrayal, and it has many of the events, many of the times I was drugged in my adult life by those I trusted, those who had befriended me or those who I associated with socially. And so I copied the part. If one paragraph referred to a certain incident, I mailed that to the group of people who were involved in that. And I sent many letters to the media too, by the way. Many letters to the media, and some people in the media received copies of the letters I sent to the perpetrators. For instance, there's one person I sent many copies of the letters I just was talking about from Chapter 8, Betrayal, that I sent to numerous people of all the different things that happened to me. Like I would send the part that those people were involved with, and I would send that copy to the media. I never got even one response from the media. These letters were all well written. They were all thoughtful. They were all respectful. I wasn't condemning anybody. And I'm not even really condemning the people who did it to me. I'm condemning their actions. And I just want to have it made known so that other people can protect themselves and protect their children.
What I find really interesting is how universal is the response in no response. And you, normally when you write to a politician, you get some thank you for your letter, stamp form back or something. But to have no response from all of those sectors, is how do you interpret that?
Well, first of all, I'm not a crackpot. I was in business for 30 years in a small town in called Mitchell in southwestern Ontario. I had a grocery store, sold the grocery store, moved to a place near the water, and ended up being in business again. Never wrote a letter to the editor in my life until I discovered the truth of what happened to me when I was in my mid-50s. I think that there's a conspiracy of silence. They all know that's going on, but no one acknowledges it. For instance, in Ontario, well, first of all, the OPP detective, I did give a statement to the police. The OPP detective I'm dealing with, I believe, is a good man. But he told me a year or so ago, I don't believe in Satanism or cults. So that probably occurred in 2014 or 13, something like that. In the mid-1990s in Ontario, there were two significant events that involved satanic ritual abuse. In one of them, they had a conference in Thunder Bay, Ontario, that was attended by law enforcement people, members of our provincial government, many people in the healing modalities were there. And this conference was held because over 30 people in Thunder Bay complained that they had been satanically ritually abused by Freemasons in that community. So they had this big conference that was attended by the media, was well known. Around the same, in the same time period in the mid-90s, there was a case of staggering proportions in eastern Ontario where over 200 children were subjected to satanic ritual abuse, which involves pedophilia. Satanism involves pedophilia almost always. And the Toronto Star, of course, only reported on the pedophilia. They didn't report about the satanic ritual abuse. This is all documented evidence. There's a book written by Toronto Star award-winning journalist Judy Steed. It's called Our Little Secret, and she's the one who covered that story. And in one of the things I read on the web, she lamented the fact that she didn't fight harder to have the incidents of Satanism, the satanic rituals, put in the newspaper. Because that, the fact they kept all that out of the newspaper robbed a whole generation of people of knowledge about satanic abuse that could have protected their children and perhaps themselves. And maybe it would have helped me protect me, too. And so there is a conspiracy of silence, because you would think that if those two monumental things involving satanic ritual abuse occurred in the mid-90s in Ontario, that people in law enforcement would change their whole training structure to reflect that fact. You would think that our learning institutions would implement changes for mental illness, social work, all those kinds of things. You would think lawmakers would make new laws that could be enacted that would help protect the public from the stuff that's out there. So that happened in the 90s, and here we are in 2014, 15, and 16, and I can't get anyone to even acknowledge or reply that what happened to my family and me and what happened to me for over 50 years occurred.
Well, it sounds familiar, Dave. It's like the same roadblock we get when we're confronting crimes of genocide in Canada. Can I ask you the name of the Anglican Church officials you wrote to? Like, did you write to the high ups in Toronto?
I've probably sent in excess of 15 letters to Primate Hiltz of the Anglican Church of Canada. I'll tell you about a meeting I had, because this will interest you, because I met with the members of the Anglican Huron Diocese of London, Ontario, in September of 2013, to tell them what happened to me as a child at St. James Anglican Church in Paris. So they listened to my story, and Ken Brooks, who was one of the representatives, said to me, "Dave, we'll check this out. If on the balance of probabilities, what you say appears to be true, we will give you the public apology that you have requested." Because that's all I've ever wanted from the Anglican Church of Canada, is an apology for me and the other people who were subjected to that as children. Because the crime is now, they know that happened, so there's a whole multitudes of people walking around my age, some older, maybe some younger, who aren't able to fulfill their potential in life because they have lacks in the areas of self-confidence, self-esteem, self-love. In other words, they're all screwed up. And if the church would admit that, they could at least know why or choose to get healing. So he said that to me about, if on the balance of probabilities what you say appears to be true, we'll give you that apology you request. But undoubtedly an untruth he spoke to me, because the Huron Diocese of London controlled the St. James Anglican Church of Paris. They would hire the ministers, the curriculum, the maintenance, the methods, the procedures, all that would come from the London Diocese. Your research talks about the Brantford Mohawk Residential School. The Mohawk Residential School in Brantford was run by the Anglican Church also. It was 7 miles from the church I went to as a boy, and was also supervised by the same Anglican Diocese. So they're staffing, their curriculum, their supervision, and all the procedures would come from the Anglican Huron Diocese in London. So the atrocities that occurred in the Brantford Residential School, at least in part, came directly from the Anglican Diocese of London, and yet he would tell me that my allegations, which are similar to what happened, that what has been admitted to as have happened at Mohawk Residential School, aren't true or couldn't have happened.
Well, not only that, I think I've told you this, but Fred Hiltz, who you wrote to, sent an order to Bishop Bob Bennett in London, Ontario, who runs the Huron Diocese and the archives there, ordering him not to release this special file called the G12 section, which had all of the evidence of the torture and murder of children at the Anglican school and the Mohawk school in Brantford. So, you know, you're dealing with the same criminals who are hiding up the residential school crimes.
Yes. I suppose that's true. Like, the Anglican Church, for me, like, I didn't care about holding them accountable. I just wanted the apology, and so that I could use that for all my other allegations that have happened me that happened to me for the rest of my life up to the ages of the 50s.
So you never got it? Did you ever hear?
I never got anything from any of those people.
So you didn't.
So I don't know how. Yeah.
They cut off contact after. Did you hear from them again?
I sent many letters to the people at the Huron Diocese. Sometimes they did reply, but, you know, they always are in complete denial.
Yeah.
One of the things that came to me that may be interesting was, I told you those letters came to me in kind of a spiritual way. I also received a document called the Ritual Abuse Task Force, which was quite a lengthy, very precise means for the premier to bring out the truth of what happened to me, or actually anyone that would have been involved with satanic cults. Because the problem with holding these people accountable, if the police actually wanted to, is that they're more afraid of the cult than they are of the law, so they would never say anything. But the document that came to me that I sent to them, one of the clauses in there says that if any person who has knowledge of, who has witnessed or has taken part in any of the crimes committed against me, gives all of the evidence at their disposal freely to the Ritual Abuse Task Force investigator, that they would receive no time of incarceration for all those crimes, although they would be convicted and charged. And that's a very powerful document, because it isn't important that these people get put in jail. What's more important is it becomes known what they do and who they are. So if there's hundreds of people that have been involved against me, so if even one of them thinks it's in their best interest to give all of the evidence at their disposal, everyone's going to have to do the same thing.
Right.
Because there's no jail time. And so that's was sent to the premier, and I sent that to most of the perpetrators also.
Dave, we've got about just over 5 minutes left, and I definitely want to have you back on again, especially there's some Aboriginal witnesses to the same kinds of crimes. I'd love to have you both on. We're going to have Sandra Fecht on in the future as well, so this is an ongoing dialogue we're having. But let me just ask you right now, if there's, in summing up this, what are the main points you want to share with the listeners?
Well, one of them would be, is the prevalence of cults and secret societies is very widespread. They are everywhere, like my mind control program says. And so we need to be aware of that fact. Two, healing is possible, but it is tough to find a person that's spiritually enough aware that they can do that healing. But I consider myself healed. I've removed all the post-traumatic stress incidents of Satanism. Now, I still have to train myself in the social skills, because my mind has been wired to fight back, to resist, to be stubborn, and so I have to work on those things, and I am working on those things. So the healing part is a big part, the prevalence of cults, and of course, it's become very aware to me that God is in charge of everything, and that this was, that I accepted this life for what I'm attempting to do now.
Dave, I
just shine the light of truth on Satanism.
Exactly. Ryan, do you have any final comments or questions?
No, I just wanted to ask what you thought of your parents to this day. How do you view them in the context of what happened?
Well, I believe I forgive them, because as I've forgiven every perpetrator, because I had hundreds involved. If I would be just like them. If I was full of hate and thoughts of revenge, I would be in a quagmire of darkness. And so I had to learn to forgive and realize that everyone is doing the best they possibly can. Socrates said, all men do what they think is good. These people just don't know any better. And so they need to be dealt with in a tough love, like sometimes we do with our wayward children.
One question I want to put out, Dave, for everyone to consider is, when the perpetrators are in charge and they have a vested interest in keeping it all hidden, maybe we need more than forgiveness. Maybe we need more than that, because they seem to be holding all the cards. I'm just putting that out there. Yeah.
You know, don't take me wrong when I say I forgive the actions of what they do. That won't stop me from trying to make known what they did and trying to stop what they do. It's just how I view them.
Okay.
And so I don't view them with hate. I view them as they know no better. They're like a child level. So it won't stop me from doing anything that I think is right, just, and proper concerning that issue.
Exactly. And we always keep the high ground. That's part of our power. Dave, I want to commend you, of course, for coming on, for your great courage, and to invite you back on. We'll talk more about some of the things you want to touch on in the future. I imagine more, if you'd like to talk about Sandra's work with you or other aspects of this. I do have, like I mentioned, Aboriginal survivors who have parallel, almost identical stories of what went on in various Anglican, Catholic, and United Church schools right across Canada. So we want to get into that in the future. Dave, thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure.
Okay, we'll talk to you again.
Okay, bye-bye.
Ryan, in the last few minutes left to us, I just wanted to flag a few things. In the next week, we're going to have Peter Yellickwell back on from the Anishinaabe Nation in Manitoba. Now, this is what we're going to be talking to Peter about, not only his own struggle against ongoing genocide, like we talked about last week, but the proclamation going out to Russia and various BRIC nations concerning the need to prosecute the Western nations for their crimes of genocide. This is something that is reaching new levels now, this appeal, and we are getting a response. We just actually received a notice recently that the Russian government will receive a delegation from the ITCCS during October to look at enforcing the arrest warrants against these officials of church and state in the West who committed these crimes. So this is very exciting. We're going to have an ongoing discussion of this and reports from this movement. Anything else you want to mention before the end of the show?
No, not too much on my mind today to throw in at the end, other than my radio program. I'll be having Sandra Fecht on again sometime in the near future, and that's about it in relationship to this content.
Okay, and a final news item I did want to share. A friend of mine gave me this today. She found out that in Bologna, Italy, last April, there were hundreds of airline pilots out in the street protesting chemtrails. Now, I've never heard this. You can trust Italy for having done this, because they'll protest anything at the drop of a hat, as I discovered when I was there outside the Vatican. But, you know, Bologna, Italy, northern Italy, hundreds of airline pilots protesting chemtrails, and it was a big demonstration. So that's a bit of a sign of hope for folks to think that we're somehow just helpless victims of what's happening in the sky. Please follow our work, itccs.org. Tune back here next week, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, bbsradio.com/radiofreecanada. And please procure our recent books, murderbydecree.com, Murder by Decree, The Crime of Genocide in Canada, Unrelenting, and The Whistleblower's Manual. All of this you can get online at amazon.com. Go to itccs.org for more information on that. And until next week, just call on everybody to stay strong, stay clear, and tune in. Thank you.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon